The headlines: Hamas joins other Palestinian groups in condemning the United Arab Emirates for opening an embassy in Israel. Lebanon's Prime Minister Designate Saad Hariri presents his cabinet proposals to President Michel Aoun. And unrest in South Africa sparks fears of food and fuel shortages as disruptions begin to bite. Thanks for joining us. The United Arab Emirates has inaugurated its embassy in Israel as part of a deal to normalize ties signed between the two sides. Mona Kandil reports from the occupied West Bank.
Following Israel's inauguration of its embassy in the United Arab Emirates, the Arab Kingdom opened its embassy in Tel Aviv, situated in the Stock Exchange building. The Palestinians were outraged by the UAE's decision to establish ties with Israel, and now opening of its embassy in Tel Aviv means that the UAE has chosen to disavow the Palestinians' rights and collaborate with the occupying regime instead of boycotting it.
The UAE's move is part of the normalization deal between the two sides and comes at a time when Israel has escalated its atrocities against the Palestinians. We expect the world to boycott the Israeli regime and pressurize it into stopping its crimes against the Palestinian people.
The flag-raising ceremony was attended by the UAE Ambassador Mohammed Al-Khaja, as well as Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who called the opening of the embassy an important milestone in Israel's journey towards the future, peace, prosperity, and security for the Middle East.
This move will help the Israeli regime to go further with its crimes against Palestinians. We hope that the latest war on Gaza could open the eyes of the Arab states on the true nature of Israel. Signing any agreement with Israel is in favor of the occupation regime's expansionist and aggressive ambitions.
Last month, Israeli Foreign Minister paid a landmark visit to the UAE and opened an embassy in Abu Dhabi and a consulate in Dubai. The UAE was the first of four Arab countries to agree to normalize ties with Israel last year under the so-called Abraham Accords, a pact brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump. Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan signed normalization deals with the Israeli regime shortly afterwards. By opening its embassy in Tel Aviv, Palestinians say the United Arab Emirates continues to reward the Israeli regime and giving up the Holy Lands. They call the UAE's latest normalization move treason. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has slammed the United Arab Emirates for opening its embassy in Israel, calling the move a stab in the back of Palestinians.
The UAE move to open an embassy within the occupation of the state is an insistence on the national scene it committed by signing the normalization agreement. This behavior is certainly harmful to the Palestinian cause and serves the narrative of the occupation. It constitutes a stab in the back of our Palestinian people and the resistance that fought the Battle of Sword of Al-Quds.
The Hamas spokesman called on the UAE to cancel its normalization deal with the Israeli regime, brokered by Washington last year. The opening of the embassy also drew condemnation from other Palestinian factions. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement called the normalization with Israel a betrayal, a crime, and an ignorance of the truth. The movement said that the UAE's move would be recorded in history as it comes at the height of Israel's crimes against Palestinians. The West Bank-based Fatah movement also decried the opening of the UAE embassy in Israel and called for the expulsion of Abu Dhabi from the Arab League. Bassem Naim is head of Hamas International Relations Office, who joins us from Gaza City. Welcome. When you take a look at what the UAE has done, tell us why you feel that this is wrong. And in the words of the Hamas spokesperson, that it's a betrayal to the Palestinian cause.
Thank you very much. We don't consider it wrong. We consider it a crime against the just Palestinian cause. It is legitimizing the Zionist existence on our land In general, it is condemned and rejected, but in particular at this time, where Gaza is, where Israel is besieging 2 million people here in Gaza for more than 15 years in a suffocating siege, where Israel is Judaizing Jerusalem and trying to eliminate the Palestinian existence in Jerusalem, where Israel is annexing most of the occupied territories in the West Bank, this is a crime against the just Palestinian cause. Second, it is a crime against the Arab national security, because we know that the Israeli long-term plans to infiltrate the Arab nations and to cause more and more damage for the Arab national security in creating problems between the different countries, in taking over the resources of the Arabic and Islamic nations, in creating a lot of internal turmoils and chaos in the different countries.
When you take a look at the security arrangements, which are not really spoken about that much, if at all, really, tell us how that could pose a danger with Israel, I'm assuming, to penetrate the security apparatus within the UAE and to use it to its own advantage.
We know that when the normalization accords between Israel and another country is signed, usually because of the Israeli sophisticated facilities and capabilities, because of the American support for the Zionist entity, they have usually the upper hand in different regions and areas, the security level and the economic level and other levels. Therefore, they will have much more power and force to penetrate the security level, the Arabic countries, to use these countries as a base for espionage against other Arab or Islamic countries, supported again by the American logistics. We know how Israel worked in different Arabic countries, in Sudan, in South Sudan against North of Sudan, in Ethiopia against Egypt, in Iraq with some groups against the other groups, and in North of Syria, for example. I mean, it is well known how Israel is operating at the security level in order to serve their own long-term plans of keeping the Arabic and Islamic countries divided and in internal clashes to serve their existence and their upper hand.
So when you take a look at the everyday Arab or everyday Palestinian viewing what has happened in terms of the UAE decision to normalize ties with Israel, how does, what kind of standing does the UAE now have with Palestinians?
Unfortunately, this is a very important question. Unfortunately, we know that other Arabic countries have some kind of relations with the Zionist entity here, but at least they didn't present this hostile terminology against Palestinians and Palestinian cause, against Palestinian factions in their language, politically, media, and in different areas. When we hear how they are talking now, or how they are speaking about Palestinians and Palestinian cause, and how they are trying to push the Israeli narrative forward, and to attack the Palestinian narrative, and to accuse the Palestinians that they have, for example, betrayed their own cause, that they are corrupted, that they are working with against each other. Unfortunately, not only normalizing relationship with the Israelis, but also attacking the Palestinians, and by the way, attacking them aggressively, and again accusing them to be betrayal of their own cause.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Pleasure talking to you. Bassem Naim, head of Hamas International Relations Office there from Gaza City. Many thanks. Moving on, in Lebanon, Prime Minister-designate Saad al-Hariri has presented his cabinet lineup to President Michel Aoun. The move could end almost 9 months of political deadlock amid an economic crisis there. Hariri has said that he is now awaiting the president's response, which is expected on Thursday. He added that the proposed cabinet is composed of 24 specialist ministers in line with the French initiative. Hariri spoke after meeting with Aoun. Lebanon has plunged deeper into what the World Bank calls one of the world's worst economic crises in modern history. Financial dilemma, which has seen the value of the currency plummet by more than 90%, has been deepened by the political deadlock. The country is without a formal government since the deadly Beirut explosion last August. Mariam Saleh says that a government acceptable to all Lebanese factions is unlikely as long as some countries try to interfere in the country's political affairs.
What we're seeing here is that this is one of the reasons why the president might not accept this lineup. What we're seeing here is perhaps a foreign formation of this cabinet. They are trying to form the cabinet on behalf of the Lebanese, as many analysts or experts are seeing, and that would be the main problem that we might see from many factions. And of course, like I said, Hezbollah and the Free Patriotic Movement had always been very careful when it came to that lineup. Who was going to be governing the country, especially since we still have a parliament in place? Are they going to be representing this parliament? Will they have laws that will be ratified by the parliament? Or we always have these issues going back and forth. So as long as we don't have a purely Lebanese cabinet, and you have, for example, certain factions in Lebanon that await, if we may say, foreign acceptance or foreign agreement on what they're trying to do and their endeavor, then it seems very unlikely that we can actually have a cabinet that is accepted by all factions and all Lebanese.
South Africa is witnessing violence and unrest for the sixth consecutive day, stoking fears of food and fuel shortages amid disruptions in several key industries. Footage and reports show a large-scale looting and vandalizing of supply chains and transport links in the commercial hub of Johannesburg and the province of KwaZulu-Natal. Farming, manufacturing, and oil refinery plants have also been hit. On Tuesday, one of the country's largest oil refineries declared an emergency shutdown, disrupting a third of the country's fuel supply. Meanwhile, the government is planning to expand military deployment to deal with the situation. The crisis engulfed South Africa after former President Jacob Zuma was jailed. More than 70 people have been killed and some 1,700 have been arrested since the violence broke out last week. The human rights advocacy group in Yemen has announced the statistics of crimes committed during the over 6 years of Saudi-led war in the impoverished Arab country. The report by the group sheds light on civilian casualties and the destruction of infrastructure by relentless bombings and shelling of Yemen by Riyadh and its allies since 2015.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report. It highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardments of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month and a controversial move added Yemen's Ansar Allah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollars, not the loss of innocent human lives.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani says that the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the 2015 nuclear deal under pressure from Israel, Saudi Arabia, and some extremist groups. Rouhani underlined that Tel Aviv, Riyadh, and the anti-Iran bloc have always sought to sabotage Tehran's efforts to deal with the world. He said the U.S. withdrawal from the accord was the result of miscalculations of its then-government advisors. Rouhani also noted that Washington did not achieve any of its goals by abandoning the agreement. The Iranian president said that his country has never deserted the multilateral accord and is still seeking to revive it. Rouhani added that the Islamic Republic could enrich uranium up to 90% purity level upon the requirement of the country's nuclear reactors. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
As governments in multiple EU states struggle to curb an increasingly alarming surge in COVID-19 cases, the Dutch Premier Mark Rutte has apologized and conceded that restrictions reinstated this weekend were lifted too soon. Meanwhile, the French President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a raft of new measures on Monday, 12th of July, including making health certificates mandatory in cafes and restaurants and on planes and long-distance trains from next month. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's Europe correspondent, John Henley. The piece is titled, Dutch PM Sorry for Early Reopening as France Tightens COVID Rules. As governments in multiple European Union states struggle to curb an increasingly alarming surge in COVID-19 cases, the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte has apologized and conceded that restrictions reinstated this weekend were lifted too soon. Meanwhile, France's President Emmanuel Macron unveiled a raft of new measures on Monday, 12th of July, including making health certificates mandatory in cafes and restaurants, and on planes and long-distance trains from next month. While cases are rising, hospital admissions in most EU countries have not so far followed the same curve, prompting officials to suggest that, as vaccination campaigns advance, hospital data should become a bigger factor in responding to the pandemic. Dutch Premier Mark Rutte last week reimposed curbs on restaurants and nightclubs in the Netherlands, and cancelled all events involving large crowds until at least 14th of August, as new cases rose almost sevenfold, from a rolling seven-day average of 49 for every million people on 4th of July to nearly 330 at the weekend. What we thought would be possible turned out not to be in practice, he said on Monday. We had poor judgment, which we regret and which we apologize. At least 30 event organizers have launched joint legal proceedings over the U-turn. The Dutch Health Minister, Hugo de Jong, said last week that holidays could be affected by the surge, but he was hopeful that other European Union countries would look at hospital data rather than infections when debating quarantine or test requirements on Dutch travelers. 2 weeks ago, all the signals were green, Hugo de Jong said. Now there is reason to intervene. This is unprecedented. However, Dutch hospital admissions remain low at 2.7 million, down from a peak of more than 100 per million in early April. Meanwhile, France's President Emmanuel Macron said in a televised address on Monday, 12th of July, that French health workers who had not been vaccinated by September would face sanctions and health certificates proving vaccination, a negative test or COVID immunity would be required in cinemas, theatres and at concerts from this month. From August, the certificate will also be required in cafes and restaurants. New infections in France have surged by 65% in a week, from an average of 34 to 56 for every million people. President Macron said PCR tests, which have been free in France until now, would have to be paid for from the end of the summer holidays, as part of a concerted drive to encourage the entire population to get vaccinated, the only sure path out of the crisis. As in much of Europe and the United States, France's rate of first-dose vaccinations has started to slow as it begins running up against more vaccine-hesitant or hard-to-reach groups, potentially threatening the goal of herd immunity. So far, 53% of the total population in France have had one dose of the vaccine and 39% are fully vaccinated. Other countries that have experienced way rapid surges include the continent's most popular holiday destinations such as Spain, Portugal and Greece. Cases in Greece and Spain have more than doubled in the past week, from seven-day averages of 69 and 157 per million of the population to 176 and 316 respectively. The Catalonia region in northeastern Spain, which includes Barcelona, has reimposed curbs on nightlife in an effort to tame an increase mainly among unvaccinated young people. Nearly half of Portugal, where average daily infections have risen from 203.7 to 265.6 for every million people in the past week, is back under a nighttime curfew, with several regions also now requiring a vaccination certificate or negative test to book into a hotel or eat indoors in a restaurant. "We continue to observe a worsening of the pandemic," a Portuguese government spokesperson, Mariana Vieira da Silva, said last week, adding that 60 Portuguese municipalities now represented a high risk of transmission, up from 45 in the previous week. New infections in Germany are rising more slowly, from an average of 6.8 per million to 9, an increase of 32%, with new weekly hospital admissions remaining low at 1.7 a million. Authorities aim to focus on hospital admissions rather than infections, German media have reported. Cases ticked up last week after 2 months of steady decline, and the German health minister, Jens Spahn, has said lifting the remaining restrictions will depend on vaccination rates, with social gatherings of more than 10 people not from the same household still banned for those who are not fully vaccinated. While 90% of the over 60s will soon be vaccinated, it will take a big publicity drive to reach a rate of 85% among the younger population, the German health minister confirmed. About 57% of Germany's total population have received at least one dose of the vaccine, and almost 39% are fully vaccinated. The German daily The Bild reported on Monday that Robert Koch Institute, RKI, the national disease control agency in Germany, was pushing for hospital admissions to be an additional leading factor when assessing the state of the pandemic. Citing a Robert Koch Institute document, The Bild said the agency believed that several indicators would still be necessary for evaluation, but their weighting should change, owing to a decrease in the proportion of severe cases due to widespread vaccination. Experts have said the Delta variant of the coronavirus could account for 70% of all cases in Europe by early next month, rising to 90% by the beginning of September.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Brother Hasnain Rajab Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everybody. May Allah bless you all for joining us tonight. And the topic tonight is the preparation for our living imam. As an introduction, first and foremost, we always have to, of course, purify ourselves. That is fundamental, that while we're helping the needy, while we're feeding the poor, taking care of the orphans, the family, and so on, we must always be working to improve ourselves. That's very critical, because that's an indicator that the hand that gives needs to be purified, otherwise it loses the efficacy of what it's doing. That's first and foremost. Secondly, we need to also be acutely aware of our responsibilities for the return of the Imam on a social, political, economic levels. And what we find is that on the social front, we are facing a very interesting phenomenon. The fact that social media has become such a tight-knit mesh with the, of course, the new advent of the 5G network. As you know, 5G now is going to take over our lives in very, very interesting ways. Some of it in very positive ways, some of it in very, very dangerous ways and negative ways, and we need to be aware of those. And we need to talk about those because the technology is becoming ubiquitous in the sense that not a single human being on earth will be able to have the kind of privacy that existed before. Today, for example, we're all carrying our cell phones. And our cell phone is a unique identifier. And even if we buy a cell phone from the street vendor and use it, some people do that as politicians, the minute you connect with any group of people, there is a pattern that is very similar to your regular cell phone pattern. They can actually now figure out this is the same person using another phone. So now you've got this phone attached to you that's basically your identifier that's constantly transmitting to the satellites. And now as a result of that, the central system is monitoring and watching what we're doing. And it knows where we are, what our patterns are, what our travel behaviors are, what our purchasing behavior is. Today you buy things from Amazon, you buy things from Google, through Google, you do searches. You buy things even electronically, when you go into a shop and you swipe your card, that's all interconnected. Our habits and behaviors are being collected, and the data machines out there are building a complete profile of who we are, whether we like it or not. That's one aspect that we need to talk about. These technologies that are becoming prevalent have an effect on how we communicate. And by Allah's grace, with this pandemic, that technology has helped us, including Zoom and so on, that enables us now to communicate at a rapid pace. But by the same token, it's all public and it's also managed. And the critical question that we must take into consideration in tonight's conversation is that this collection of data is being done by a group of people in conglomerates, very elite, select group of people who have access to this information. And we know that most of them don't have ethical, moral values that will really take humanity to higher stations closer to God. And we all agree that we are moral beings at the end of the day. And if it's in the hands of the wrong people, then we know that we're going in the wrong direction. You know, it's interesting when Hollywood made the movie Matrix, and they made a whole series of them, you know, sequels after sequels. The problem was consistent from the perspective that you have this very elite group of people controlling, and everybody's coming out of the pod, and you have to obey the system, right? And that's dangerous, because that's mind control. George Orwell's 1984 idea, where you're being suppressed and oppressed, you know, potentially. So the conversation of the return of the Imam is crucial every single hour, every single day, and it's accelerating. And I think we need to address that. We as a society also have to understand that when we study human behavior, we're noticing that, for example, suicide and depression is on the rise. There is no question about it. It's actually statistically alarming. It's an alarming statistics where our kids are getting more depressed. More children are killing themselves now than ever in the history before. And I remember as a child, we used to walk the streets from home all alone and go to school, come back, go on the streets, play marbles. We used to play cricket. We used to play, you know, soccer, basketball, volleyball, whatever. Today, we've got parents who have become essentially, most of them, helicopter parents who don't let their children leave their homes because they're afraid they'll get kidnapped or something. Though our technology today to track a child is much greater than then, you find children now don't go out as much, and our parks are shrinking. Our children are hardly going out into those what we call physical activity zones. And therefore, there's this depression on the rise. But we also have to discuss, is it this technology that's become so prevalent to us that our children today are carrying very sophisticated computers in their hands, on their hands and on their wrists, you know, and on their eyes, and now they're able to communicate and do things. Is that contributing so much to this rise in depression and suicide? And what can we do about it? You know, or is it the fact that the ethical moral systems of our societies abandon God from schools, abandon the whole conversation about the divine, or we've added more confusion to the whole conversation, or because schools no longer allow the conversation about God except in specific classes, and this is the net reaction now, the result of depression? These are things that we need to talk about. Secondly, we need to talk about what can we do once we see this problem. How can we plug in ourselves and the resources that we have to reduce and alleviate, if not eradicate, these problems? Extremely important. Social intervention. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in 4 years and 9 months as the Khalifa, made sure that he instituted some critical components to limit poverty. And you saw the effects of it. By our sixth Imam, there was wealth in the community. The Muslim community had reached its pinnacles around the 7th, 8th Imam. You find it became the learning center of the world. You know, this didn't happen because of the caliphs. It happened because our Imams were proactively infusing systems and methods by which to alleviate poverty of the mind, poverty of the spirit. These are all conversations that we need to talk about. And of course, we can't come up with all the solutions, but fundamentally, from a social perspective, we need to look at it. Our children, how do we enhance their spirituality? And when we talk about preparation for the living Imam, we're talking about at this level. How about our educational system? We're all mimicking the Western lifestyles. Everything is brain-based, brain-based, brain-based. Quran is all heart-based, heart-based, heart-based. And he's telling me that my real mind lies in my heart. Educational systems today don't really cater to that. We take our kids and put them in a classroom, and then we start talking about Allah, and we call it an Islamic school. Sure, the environment is Islamic, but a lot of that, what we call secular knowledge, does not infuse the divine presence. When our scientists like Al-Khwarizmi and Ibn Sina, right, and Jabir bin Hayyan, of course Imam Jafar Sadiq, who was the teacher of chemistry, every sentence, hydrogen, helium, there was subhanallah, mashallah in it. Do we have that? Not really. Many of these factors need to be realigned. And it's a monumental task from a social level, economic level. We don't have any real Islamic banking systems. All our Islamic banking systems today, even famous Islamic banks like Habib Bank, they're all following Western systems of interest. And this is something that in this conversation we're not going to crack, but we're going to address so that it's food for thought. And inshallah, who knows, maybe a few of us in this conversation we'll go home and say, wow, that was a mind-provoking conversation. And hopefully I can do something that may become an incubation for something 10 years from now that may become a grand system that will be absorbed on a grander scale. Because everything starts from grassroots. May Allah give us the tawfiq, inshallah.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Alim Halim Hakim Mati.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A group of Texas Democratic lawmakers plan to flee their state in a desperate bid to stop the Republican-run legislature from passing laws that they say will suppress the vote of people of color. We're prepared for you an article written by Sam Levine. The piece is titled Texas Democrats Planning to Flee the State to Thwart Voting Restrictions Law. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Texas Democrats plan to flee the state as part of an all-out effort to block Republicans from passing new restrictions on voting in the state of Texas. The move, first reported by NBC News, escalates one of the most high-stakes battles over efforts to make it harder to vote in America. It comes just days into a special legislative session in Texas in which Republicans are advancing measures that would impose new identification requirements on mail-in ballots, ban 24-hour and drive-through voting, and empower partisan poll watchers. Texas, a state Donald Trump handily won in 2020, is already one of the hardest places to vote in the United States. It is among a handful of states that do not have online voter registration, nor does it allow everyone to vote by mail, only allowing those who are 65 years old, have a disability, or who meet other criteria to do so. Texas was among the states with the lowest turnout in the 2020 presidential election. This will be the second time Texas lawmakers have walked out of the Capitol to deny Republicans the required two-thirds quorum needed to conduct business. In late May, Democrats walked out of the regular session of the legislature, thwarting an earlier version of the voting bill. Republicans have pressed on with a similar version of that bill in the special session, though they dropped two of its most egregious provisions, a measure cutting early voting hours on Saturdays and another that would have made it easier for judges to overturn elections. The Democratic decision to flee the state offered a jolt of energy to national Democrats who have watched Republicans across the country use their majorities in state capitals to enact several new measures to impose voting restrictions. Meanwhile, Democrats have failed in their efforts in Washington to pass comprehensive voting rights legislation. NBC News reported several of the Democrats fleeing Texas plan to travel to Washington, D.C., to advocate for federal voting legislation. Democratic leaders in the State House of Representatives said in a statement, "We're now taking the fight to our nation's capital. We are living on borrowed time in Texas." They urged Congress to pass the For the People Act, which includes several provisions that would expand voter access, as well as an updated version of the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act. Gilberto Hinojosa, the chairman of the Texas Democratic Party, supported lawmakers as they left the state. He said in a statement, "We will not stand by and watch Republicans slash our right to vote, silence the voices of Texans of color, and destroy our democracy, all to preserve their own power. Our lawmakers have refused to be complicit in Republicans' destructive attacks, and they're doing what Texans need them to do, hold the line so that not one more anti-voter law can be passed in Texas." With no quorum, Republicans in the state legislature will be unable to proceed with any business in the special session, which can last a maximum of 30 days. According to NBC News, Democrats who flee the state face potential arrest, as state Republicans can authorize law enforcement to haul the Democratic legislators back to the state. Republicans did just that in 2003, when Democratic lawmakers fled the state in an effort to block new electoral maps that would favor Republicans. Dade Phelan, a Republican and a Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, said Republicans would use every available resource under the state constitution and rules of the House to secure a quorum. If needed, the rules of the Texas House allow legislators to authorize the sergeant-at-arms to arrest lawmakers to secure a quorum. He said in a statement, "These actions put at risk state funding that will deny thousands of hardworking staff members and their families a paycheck, health benefits, and retirement investment, so that legislators who broke quorum can flee to Washington, D.C. in private jets." He added, "The special session clock is ticking. I expect all members to be present in our capital in order to immediately get to work on these issues." The New York Times reported as recently as last week that there was not widespread consensus among Democrats on whether to flee the state. The New York Times said some Democrats, realizing they could not block Republicans from passing new restrictions forever, favored staying and fighting the legislation on procedural grounds and proposing amendments to win key concessions. Some worried that fleeing the state would make it look like Democrats were abandoning their legislative responsibilities. Those in favor of fleeing argued it would bring new spotlight on the fight over voting rights in Texas. NBC News reported 58 of the 67-member Democratic caucus are expected to flee the state. Republicans began advancing the new voting bill on Saturday, 10th of July, in a committee hearing that lasted into the early hours of the Sunday morning. Hundreds of people signed up to testify against the measure and waited hours to do so. In 2003, Democrats in the state legislature fled to Oklahoma and New Mexico in an effort to block Republicans from passing new electoral maps that benefited Republicans. Republicans were eventually able to get a quorum when a Democratic state senator broke ranks with his colleagues and returned to the Capitol. Reports at the time noted the difficulties lawmakers faced in being out of the state for so long. Some did not pack enough clothes. They also paid for hotel rooms out of pocket and refused to take a per diem. Texas Republicans also stripped Democrats of their parking spaces at the Capitol while they were out of the state and threatened to tow the car of one state senator. There have been walkouts over controversial pieces of legislation in other states in recent years. For example, in 2011, Wisconsin Democrats fled the state over the anti-union bill, prompting the state Senate to authorize law enforcement to bring them back. Republicans maneuvered to pass the bill anyway. In 2019, Republicans in the Oregon legislature have also fled the capital in recent years in fights over climate bills.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The Judiciary Transformation Plan is a solid and practical plan. The movement has begun. Well, a plan was prepared in the judiciary. Later, this plan was revised, and we saw the second upgraded version of that plan presented by Mr. Raisi. The plan is good and well prepared. Some plans are prepared here and there for the sake of formality, and they only state some bland generalities. But there is no generality in this plan. This plan is a good, strong plan. It is specifically long-term, and it has a timetable for various projects. It has determined the basis and direction of the movement, which indicates that this plan is, in the true sense of the word, operational, and not a plan with extravagant and impractical goals. This is a good plan, and you should use it as a standard for your work. Of course, it may be necessary to update this plan over time, but this does not mean that the trajectory should be subject to constant change. The path must be a clear and direct path. Another point is that everyone should be informed of this plan. I have received reports that some influential people in the judiciary do not know about it correctly. The plan should be made public so that experts in the judiciary branch can see it. Firstly, everyone should define and understand their duties on the basis of the plan. And secondly, if they have an opinion, they should reflect it to higher authorities, so no one should remain uninformed. The necessity to fill the legal gaps. Another thing about the plan is that I heard there are some legal vacuums, that is, laws are needed to fully implement this document. You have to pursue these laws and you should not wait for the Majlis to do so. You could prepare the required law and do not let the gap remain unfilled. In addition, the body of the judiciary branch should be encouraged to implement this plan. You can implement all kinds of encouragements and incentives. This was one point about the transformation plan in the judiciary branch and its complete execution and follow-up process.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.